Part 1. 31 Hours. Dawn made builders, and Magnus thinkers. Gilliman raised bureaucrats, while Lorgar made priests and the Khan vagrants. Of all the legions, we are the only ones who are exactly what the Emperor wanted. All that the Legiones Astartes were ever meant to be. Conquerors. We aren't meant for the world that is coming, the new world that will rise from the ashes. We are only meant to burn this one down. Attributed to Gear, Master of the Warhounds Legion. Chapter 1. It was upon a long-abandoned disk of void-hardened silver, glittering from where it perched over the curve of a slowly turning world, that the representatives of two civilizations would meet, and the fate of that world would be determined. One side of the summit had appeared out of the fury of a silent storm, a massive fleet of dozens upon dozens of brutal warships, their armored hulls lacquered in clean white, edged with deep blue, and bristling with countless weapons batteries. They had torn themselves loose from a rupture in the material universe. The incredible violence of their arrival made all the more alarming by the numbing silence of the void. Emerging as though vomited out by the warp itself, the fleet quickly took shape, congealing into a practiced, regimented order as smaller vessels and squadrons of nimble escort craft aligned themselves within the shadows of the great leviathans holding pride of place at the center of their formation. Orspecs and deep-range scanner sweeps slashed out in ripping arcs from the newcomers, invisible nets cast by the commanders of each warship to draw in and consume every iota of data available to them about their surroundings. Information about the system and its lone habitable world was scarce, beyond the basest of surveys conducted decades before, when the planet had first been rediscovered. Designated as 9315, the 15th world rendered compliant by the 93rd Expeditionary Fleet, the world had been brought into the fold of the Emperor's realm without bloodshed. With no need for their blades, its conquerors had departed 9315 once an imperial regency had been installed to rule it and integrate it into the wider Imperium. Contact with that regent had ceased, with neither word nor tithe reaching distant Terra for more than 15 standard solar years. Such was the monumental scale of man's continually expanding dominion that such a length of time had passed before the throne world had taken notice. The call went out, the task of investigation given to whichever of the Legion expeditionary fleets was nearest. Terra demanded that the source of 9315's silence be ascertained, be it calamity or treachery. So it would be, then, either by fate or the dark intervention of some higher being, that the 12th Legion, the Eater of Worlds, would answer. Of the other half of the meeting there was no sign. No emissaries presented themselves, bowing and scraping before the bladed might of the Legiones Astartes, seeking to spare themselves a legion's wrath. No defense fleet pickets darted out from high orbit, the Voxnet alive with cries of defiance and demands to live free of the Emperor's rule. There was life on the planet below, abundant, vibrant, and advanced, though the only hint of its intentions had been seen in the dreams of the fleet's astropaths. Every node of the Imperium's stellar communications network, serving in the choirs throughout the Armada, had experienced the same rapid vision. As subjective and idiosyncratic as the art of astropathy was, the ability to convey a singular message across an entire fleet of souls spoke of a psychic power potent enough to give the arrivals pause. Upon translation from the warp, each astropath's mind flashed with the image of a derelict platform orbiting the planet, framed within a wordless melange of senses evoking union and exchange. Thus interpreted and codified, the meeting ground was decided. The delegation of World Eaters arrived on the platform via Stormbird insertion. Despite being capable of rapidly delivering a strike force of 50 legionaries into the heart of even the fiercest of combat zones, in this instance, only 6 warriors departed from the gunship, marching down its forward assault ramp before the craft returned to the void with a draconic burst of flame from its engine arrays. A flat plain of silver extended before the Space Marines for a kilometre in every direction. The distant light of the system's star, not unlike that of Terra's Sol, reflected from their armour of clean marble and oceanic blue. With no destination given, and no path to lead them, they made for the only landmark visible to them, a shallow crystal dome at the platform's centre. Their boots clanked with heavy magnetised tread, disturbing the dust of ages crystallised by ice. The foremost of their number strode forth with the assured stride of one unafraid to meet whatever might lie before him, a master of war who had been born to deliver conquest. His features were obscured by his armoured helm, a Mark II, plated in bronze in the manner of a Legion veteran, and topped by the distinctive transverse crest that marked him as a centurion and a company commander. He carried a spear, longer than he was tall, with its haft resting casually against one shoulder, while a chain axe and Volkite Serpenta pistol were slung at his hips. Only one feature distinguished him from his kindred, as one other of their party bore a centurion's crest upon his helm. Their armour was all the same, marble and blue, unadorned by the filigree and pomp that embellished the armour of other legions. A single item of the lead warrior's panoply set him apart, one that told any world-eater at a glance that this was Major, captain of the 18th. It was the cloak he wore. The simple raiment of flexible iron thread, its bronze, cream, and midnight blue hues now clashing against the new colours that marked the warriors who had been reborn as the Eaters of Worlds. Majo did not concern himself with matters of aesthetics, and none of his kindred were fool enough to broach the subject with the centurion. He would wear the cloak with pride until the day he gave his last breath. The mantle had been presented to him directly, following the conquest of the Volscaeon Cybermancy, where Majo had led the 18th Company into the teeth of the fiercest fighting in support of a beleaguered force of his brother warhounds. It had been Major's skill as a commander that had turned the tide against the enemy, orchestrating his warriors to punch through the flank of a massed cybernetic horde and shatter its cohesion. It was his spear that had brought low the Archmage, leading the resistance against the 12th, and it had been his axe that had taken the Witch Lord's head. Gear himself had laid the cloak over Majo's shoulders at the end of the compliance before the legion's assembled might in the triumphal hall of the Adamant Resolve. It was the last honour the legion master would bestow upon one of his warrior brothers, before the summons of none other than the Master of Mankind himself brought the warhounds to a backwater world in the galactic east, a world that they would later come to know as New Syria. Gear was a legion master who led from the vanguard, the first blade to draw blood whenever the hounds made war. He had been the first of the 12th Legion to meet their father, and then their father had murdered him. 4 of the other legionaries followed closely behind their captain, the rims of their shoulder guards edged in a thin red stripe, designating them as members of Majo's command squad. Orontes, Majo's first axe, never strayed far from his centurion's side, the immense two-handed chain axe that marked him as champion of the 18th held loosely in his grip. Following directly behind Majo was Astakos, a veteran of the Legion's founding on Terra and bearer of the company's standard. In the rear prowled the newest of Majo's cadre, Hanno, the Dimarcurius, spinning his twin phallux blades to keep his wrists loose, and Tethys, the blue lacquer of the Legion's Librarius, barely dry upon his armour. Arriving at the Crystal Dome, the Space Marines entered through its lone opening and came to a halt at its centre. Majo set the butt spike of his spear down, its impact felt only as a slight tremor through his boots. The legionary's helms swiveled, panning their sight across their unadorned surroundings. They took in the void stretching overhead and the milky, storm-tossed sphere of the planet below. None of the warriors spoke, and no tension tightened their postures as they awaited the opposite delegation. The last of the World Eaters stood a pace separate from the others, the only legionary present neither of Majo's command squad nor of the 18th. Like Majo, he had been born on Terra, inducted into the 12th close to the same time, and through valour and blood he had elevated himself to the rank of centurion. In the days since the discovery of the Primarch, however, he had set himself apart from any other in his legion by becoming the first warhound to meet the gaze of their gene-sire and live to speak of it. It was through his efforts that Angron had been convinced to assume command over his sons on the day that the warhounds died and the Eaters of Worlds rose in their place. He was the 8th Assault Company captain, the Equerry, the eyes and ears of the Primarch.
"Gone,"
said Major, as his internal auspex chimed. The other centurion's grip tightened reflexively around the haft of the axe he carried, eliciting the slightest of creaks as the material flexed. The entrance to the dome sealed itself behind the World Eaters, knitting closed into the surrounding crystal as though it had never existed. Soft gasps echoed around the dome's interior, and the visors of the legionaries chirped and pulsed as their auto-senses detected and conveyed the changes to their environment.
"Atmosphere," said Orontes.
And then the envoys were before them.